Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Even Better Than the Real Thing, a romantic comedy by Melanie Summers, narrated by Aria Holland and Dan Kelly. Chapter 1. Finley. Today is a very big day. One that took years' worth of days to get to, and one that, if you mess it up, will pretty much ruin the years to come after it. I finally have a meeting with Dr. Daniela Beecham, senior professor of art history at England's prestigious Carlisle Institute of Art, expert on women artists throughout the Middle Ages, and person who will either make my career or crush me like a June bug. She's been the most sought-after advisor in the program every year since the early 2000s. Every professor wants to be her, and every student wants to be with her. In a non-sexual way, of course. Actually, I can't know that for sure. For all I know, there could be some students who want to be with her. But she'd never do that. She's above anything tawdry, which is one of the many reasons I'd do just about anything to work with her. Me and just about every other art history student. The fight to become one of Dr. Beecham's students is more competitive than a Texas beauty pageant. She meets with 30 applicants a year and only chooses 3. So the odds are not exactly what you'd call good. But if you can get her to agree to be your advisor, you're pretty much guaranteed to go on to get whatever job you want when you finish your PhD. So it's worth the risk of rejection. I nearly killed myself coming up with what I believe to be an incredible thesis topic, then spent another solid month working on the proposal. And much to my delight, she agreed to meet with me. First hurdle cleared. Now, to make the very best impression possible so she can't say no. And if there's anything a Southern woman knows how to do, it's to make a good impression. Having grown up in Georgia, I was taught the importance of good manners and social graces. The yes please ma'ams and no thank you sirs. Here in England, I've found that Southern charm works every bit as well here as it does back home. So long as I don't sound like I'm from there. Being American is bad enough, especially in my chosen field of study, but being from the South is unforgivable. As it is, it's no secret that people who didn't grow up in the South tend to think we're all so dumb we'd have to study for a urine test. But just like any other stereotype out there, it's simply not true. Just like any other place on the planet that has people, Georgia's got those from all walks of life and all levels of intellect and ambition. In fact, the 39th president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, was from Georgia, and that's pretty much as high as you can go in the world. So, I'd say Georgia is just as good a place to get started in life as anywhere else. And I'm sorry, but there are just as many stupid people on this side of the pond. Only we Americans tend to let their accent trick us into believing they're smarter than they are. In the decade since I moved to London, I've managed to shed my accent, except when I'm riled up or drunk. Although a Southern woman doesn't admit to being drunk, only to having been overserved. I leave my Southernisms in my brain, quickly translating them into less colorful descriptions, never saying y'all and keeping the G on the end of any word that has one. None of that makes me smarter, but it does mean I don't have to go through the extra effort of proving I'm not extra dumb because I come from the wrong part of America. I've felt like a traitor the entire time I've been here. But it's better to give up a part of yourself than give up your dreams. And this is one Southern girl with dreams so big and shiny, they took her away from everything she knew at the tender age of 18. Today is the culmination of all those lonely nights aching to be back home, lying in my twin bed back on my parents' peanut farm, listening to the sounds of crickets and the frogs croaking while I drift off to sleep. It's the climax of going to school part-time while working full-time to pay for it all. It's 10 years of bad roommates, bad meals, and bad-tempered professors. It's putting up with snooty students who grew up in manors and live in airy apartments that their rich parents pay for, and who laugh at me behind my back, and sometimes in front of my face, when they find out where I'm from. It's fighting to prove that I'm not some hick that can be dismissed as nothing. It's working 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. as a data entry clerk for Stewart Private Equity Firm, then rushing over to the university in time for class. 10 full years of developing a thick skin, getting by on no sleep, working on papers until my eyes are blurry. But if Dr. Beecham will take me on today, it'll all have been worth it. I took the day off work, even though our meeting isn't until 5 this evening. I wanted to focus all my energy on preparing and arrive as fresh as possible. I'm dressed in my very best serious art student outfit, a white button-up blouse with an olive-green cardigan and black pants. This is in sharp contrast to my usual flowy bohemian style I've cultivated over countless Saturday mornings in vintage shops around the city. Pulling out my phone, I use it as a mirror to triple-check my makeup as the tube whisks me from my crappy shared apartment in Croydon to glorious Mayfair, where the Carlyle Institute is happily situated across the street from the Savoy and one block north of the River Thames. A rush of excitement comes over me. I'm here. I made it. Almost. A text comes in from my best friend in the world, Chilani Singh, fellow data clerk at Stewart Equity, whose desk butts up against mine. We used to pretend we couldn't hear each other's drama when we'd get private calls, but at some point, we both realized it was pointless and just gave in and started commenting. Chilani. Knock 'em dead today, Finn. Me. Fingers crossed that she's sitting in her office right now wishing she could have an American for once. Chilani. Or that everyone else she's meeting with sucks ass. Me. That too. How's work going? Chilani. I'm working my fingers to the bone as usual. She's not. Chilani is a bona fide computer genius who started at the firm 6 months after me. She quickly whipped up a program to automate our job, which made my life infinitely better. Life before Chilani was getting up at 4 a.m. every day to work my butt off, then rush to the university to take classes, and go home to eat, study, and do homework until I dropped. Life after Chilani is getting up at 4 a.m. to go sit at my desk while I get all my course reading and online research done, rushing off to the university for 3 hours, then relaxing, having a bit of a life, before going to bed at 9. Literally, our only job now is to show up at 5 a.m. and run the numbers from the Asian markets. We turn on our computers, open a few programs, then do whatever we want until our shift ends at 1. Which, in Chilani's case, means reading gossip columns and scrolling through Pinterest. Only the two of us know about the software she installed, so everyone else thinks we're busy little bees, working away in the back corner, keeping all the numbers straight. Me. Well, I'll work double time tomorrow to make up for my absence. Chilani. You better. I've had at least 100 clever things to say and no one to hear them. It's awful. Me. Bless your heart. Chilani. Don't you bless your heart, me. I know what that means. Me. No, you don't. It's like aloha. So many meanings. I better run. My stop is next. Chilani, good luck. You got this. Lord, I hope so.
Chapter 2. Hayden. There are two types of people in this world. Those who want something from you, and those who pretend they don't. Relationships of every type are transactional in nature, and the sooner one accepts this, the better off you will be. My parents began to impart this wisdom upon me at a very young age, and it's perhaps one of the only things either of them gave me for which I have even the remotest hint of gratitude. Their brief and awful marriage was purely transactional. He requiring both the respectability that comes with marrying the right girl and the heir she could and did give him, and she requiring money and status. Once she had assisted him in securing the family bloodline, he fucked off and did whatever and whomever he wanted, until one day, when I was 4 apparently, he fell madly in love with one of the whomevers and left us. Since my purpose of existing in order to carry on the name had been served, he felt no obligation to have contact with me from that point on. My existence served my mother only insofar as to bring in sizable child support payments so that I would be raised in a manner befitting the son of an earl. Read, enough cash for a gigantic house and to pay for a boarding school so I'd be out of her hair. I know there are those who grew up believing in real love and that humans are generous and kind by nature, and to them I say with all due respect, you are wrong. They will cite examples such as the love a mother has for her child, which I would argue is purely transactional. All those years of supposed selflessness in raising one's offspring are merely securing their own future caregiver. The child is meant to pay it back several decades later when one's saintly mother is suffering from the ill effects of aging. A side benefit to child rearing is the respect and adoration garnered for those who choose to go down that road. Oh, well done, you. You've added to the world's overpopulation problem. But what about true love? That's the argument most people come to next, and for this, I have the very same answer. Marriage is the negotiation that never ends. I'll cook dinners if you do the shopping and the clean-up. I'll make all the money if you agree to take responsibility for the house, the children, gift-giving, making plans, planning holidays, and looking after my parents when they get old. I'd like sex 3 times a week. I'd like it once every 2 weeks. Let's settle on 3 times per month with guaranteed relations on my birthday and our anniversary. What people don't realise is that the entire thing is set up to fail. People enter into it under the guise of being in love, only to start scorekeeping and asking, "What have you done for me lately?" the second they get home from the honeymoon. Why anyone chooses to get married is beyond me. When it comes right down to it, I suspect most people enter into it to avoid loneliness, for which marriage is not a failsafe. I suppose what they're really gaining is the ability to avoid the embarrassment of appearing lonely. But in reality, the endless nightmare of tit-for-tat, i.e. marriage, can and should be avoided by understanding that loneliness is for the weak of mind. It's for people too dull to find ways to stimulate their brains through self-improvement, ambition, and the pursuit of suitable entertainment. I live alone, and yet I'm not lonely. I have a full, rich life. I travel extensively. I eat at the world's best restaurants, drink the finest whiskey. I have the best views of London in both my office and my massive luxury flat. I have wildly fun, short-term relationships with women who want the same thing as me, and who understand the deal going in. The trade-off is one for one, and the currency is orgasms. Other than that, my best relationships are with my employees. This is because employer-staff relations are built on the honesty that can only come in the form of a paycheck. I have 102 employees here at Stewart Private Equity, and even though I couldn't tell you the names of more than a dozen of them, I can tell you that my relationship with each of them gives me more satisfaction than those which one would call personal. The one exception to all of this can be found in a childhood friend, one with whom you suffered through the indignity of puberty, the impatience of youth, faced the same bullies and the same horrid teachers, been rejected by the same pretty girls, and you somehow choose to maintain the friendship even after the days of shared experience have ended. I have exactly one true friend in this world. But if you choose well, one is all you need. Caleb McNally, anesthesiologist and all-round decent guy is that person for me. Caleb doesn't subscribe to my theory on human relations, however, and has made the tactical error of getting married recently, albeit to a lovely stage actor named Ava. I like Ava. She's extremely self-assured, lacks any sense of neediness, and doesn't require 100% of Caleb's time and attention. And because her shows are in the evenings and weekend afternoons, it means I get to see him much more often than I would if she were, say, a dentist. Anyway, the fact that I'm thinking about any of this is the fault of my assistant Edna, who just left for lunch. She's been on my arse to go see my father, who is apparently in his last days on this earth. A few minutes ago, she popped her grey head in here to see if I wanted her to pick up something for me at the deli. I did. Pastrami and Swiss sandwich on rye, extra mayo, bag of plain crisps on the side. After taking my order, she left a slip of paper on my desk. The train scheduled to York for today. On the top it said, "Tomorrow's Friday. Go for your own sake, not his." Balling it up, I toss it in the bin under my desk, then get back to reading a rather dull prospectus for a new shipping company. I keep at it for the remainder of the day, barely noticing when Edna sets my lunch down in front of me or when the rest of the staff start to file out for the evening. "Well, that's me, boss," Edna says, standing at the door with her purse in hand. "Thank you, Edna. Have a nice night." I set my attention back on my computer screen, hoping that will serve as hint enough that I do not want to talk about my father. There's a long pause that suggests she's deciding whether or not to take the hint. "You too. Oh, I know you won't want to hear it, but James Dawson called again. He says it's in your best interest to call him back immediately." "Did he now?" I ask without looking up. James Dawson is my father's barrister. "I really think you should call him back, Hayden. What if there's something you need to know?" I finally look back up at her. "There isn't. Mr. Dawson is just doing his job. He's likely been instructed to try a new tactic by a man who couldn't have cared less about me until the last few weeks. A man who, for once in his life, is not going to win. Now, is there anything else?" Her shoulders drop and she shakes her head, her silvery bob slightly out of time with her neck. "No, but take it from someone who knows. You can't get this moment back. And for that, I'm grateful," I say. "Enjoy your evening, Edna." I turn my attention back to my work rather than forcing myself to face her disappointment. She's probably wondering how anyone could be so callous as to refuse to go see his dying father. But the real question she should be asking herself is, who taught me to be this way?
Chapter 3. Finley. Daniela Beecham does not have the typical professor's office you see in the movies. It's not cramped or piled with books and stacks of unmarked papers. It's not dusty or dark. And there is no creaky wood chair that was built in the 1940s. Instead, it's a large, airy space, painted white with a hint of blush. Her light wood desk has nothing on it other than her laptop and a trio of succulents in white pots. A drafting table sits behind the desk facing the back wall, and her white chair has a mesh back and leather seat. One wall has a set of bookshelves lining it, but the books and artworks are sparse and neatly arranged, giving a minimalist look to the collection. A plush area rug with sage green, ivory, and pink hues in an abstract pattern that pulls it all together. I arrive 5 minutes early, breaking out in a nervous sweat as I peek in through the partially opened door. There she is, the legend herself. Professor, author, expert, champion of women's rights. I'm immediately glad I went with a white dress shirt, as she's wearing one too. But then I realize hers has an extra button undone, and worry that I'll look too closed off if I don't do the same. But that's just silly, isn't it? Her dark brown hair is streaked with gray that somehow adds to her authority. It's as though she's too busy to bother to hold on to her youth. Maybe she just doesn't care what others think of her. A thought I find simultaneously terrifying and freeing. She's staring at her screen through a pair of tortoiseshell glasses, and I can't help but wonder if she's going over my proposal to refresh her memory about me before our meeting. I pause, wondering if I should knock so she'll know I'm here early, or wait since she looks busy. Come on now, Finley. You know how to do this. Just relax and exude the confidence of a toddler. Without looking up, she says, You can come in, Miss Green. There's no sense in hovering at the door. Oh, damn. Off to a bad start already. But I can turn this ship around. Plastering on my most winning smile, I stride into her office. Good afternoon, Dr. Beecham. And thank you so much for considering me, I say in my smoothest, least southern voice. I hold out my right hand and she looks up at it, then at me, without getting up. Instead of shaking hands, she gestures to the empty seat next to me. So, here's the thing, she says. Your grades are fine. The sample writing you sent is decent enough. Your thesis idea, the evolution of female beauty standards in England during the Enlightenment, AD 1650 to AD 1780, is, well, frankly, overdone and boring as all hell for someone at my stage in her career. Well, shit. Did she just ask me here to see my face when she rejects me? What kind of sick person would do that? Sure, I know it needs some finessing, but I was hoping together we'd come up with something really exciting for both of us. Wrinkling up her nose, she says, That's not really what I do. My face flames with humiliation, and tears prick the backs of my eyes, but I jam them back in with sheer willpower. Smile, Finley. Just keep smiling. This can't be it. You do have one thing that no one else does, however, Dr. Beecham says, leaning back in her chair. Is it being American? I ask, a flicker of hope rising in my chest. Because if so, I agree. I'm sure it will allow me to bring a fresh perspective to things. Definitely not, she says, her face looking like she was weaned on a pickle. No, it says in your CV that you work at Stewart Equity. She wants financial advice? Yes, but I'm just a data clerk there. I really can't advise you on funds or anything. Shaking her head, she says, No, no, I would never ask that of a student. I'm wondering how closely you work with Hayden Stewart. She wants me to set her up? Oh, sweetie, he is way too young for you. I don't know him at all, really. Although he did stop by my desk at Christmas with a gift card for Marks and Spencer's, so that was nice. I think he might be single, just based on office gossip, of course. Her expression says I'm barking up the wrong tree. You probably don't know this, but your boss is the next Earl of Pemberton. I did not. I thought as much. Pemberton Hall is rumored to be home to one of the best collections of artwork in all of England. They've apparently got more than one John Vanderbanks, a Hogarth, and some say even a Da Vinci. But I don't believe it. Sitting forward, her eyes light up. Pemberton Hall is one of few castles that hasn't been opened up to the public. And despite repeated requests from various members of the Royal Society, they have never allowed their collection to be studied. Well, that's a little rude, don't you think? I ask. Frustrating, she says, standing and walking over to the shelf. Very frustrating. Selecting a book, she flips through a few pages, then, finding the one she's looking for, brings the book over to me. Holding it up, she points to a photo of a painting of a man and his dog. The man is clearly a 17th century aristocrat, based on the wide lace collar, the full-sleeved navy doublet, and his matching breeches. This is Lord James Stewart, as painted by Anthony van Dyck himself in 1633. The picture was taken back in the 1680s by a house guest, who, after getting caught photographing their collection, was asked to leave the party and was subsequently banned from the property. This isn't the painting I'm interested in, however. It is believed that Lord Stuart commissioned Van Dyck to paint another portrait during the same period. It's of a woman named Sarah Jennings, mistress to James Stuart and best friend to his wife Anne. Daniela shuts the book and returns it to the shelf. If the painting does exist, it could help solve a murder committed nearly 400 years ago. She turns, her eyes wild with excitement. If there is a painting, it would serve as proof that James was throwing his affair in Anne's face. But instead of taking it out on him, which would have gotten her head lopped off in short order, I believe Anne killed Sarah. What is this? An episode of The Real Housewives of the Tudor period? I had no idea you were so interested in old gossip. This type of thing. Nodding, she returns to her chair. The truth is, I've been searching for some sort of juicy scandal for years now, something that will help renew interest in our field, which in turn fills the coffers. If I can prove what I think happened, it would mean talk shows, podcast appearances, maybe even a book deal. For a second, I'm caught up in the fantasy, imagining myself as the person she brings along on her ride to fame. But then it hits me that none of this is going to happen. And when it doesn't, she's going to blame me, isn't she? As much as I would love to be part of all that, and I really, really would, I don't think I can get you access to Mr. Stewart's collection. How could you possibly know that? You haven't had a chance to try. Mr. Stuart isn't exactly what you'd call approachable. Sighing, Dr. Beecham says, "That's too bad, Finley. I had hoped to find you more ambitious, but I can see that isn't the case." "I assure you I am very ambitious, Dr. Beecham," I tell her, my stomach feeling like a big old bowling ball. "And I am serious about the history of art. I left everything I knew to come here and study. I work full-time to keep the bills paid and have taken out some hefty loans to get by. I never take a test I'm not prepared for. I never turn in a paper with a typo. Art is my life. And if I could just have a chance, I know I could prove it to you." She stares at me, long enough for me to wonder if maybe her brain seized up. Then she says, "So, prove it. Get me access to Pemberton Hall." "No, I didn't. I'm afraid I have another meeting to prepare for, but I do so look forward to hearing from you soon." She offers me a smile that ends at the top of her cheeks. In her eyes, I see both a threat and a promise. If I don't do what she wants, I can pretty much kiss my dreams goodbye. But if I do... 5:05 a.m. the next morning. "She wants you to do what?" Chelani says, as the two of us stand in the lunchroom waiting for the coffee to brew. "Get access to his house. Well, I guess it's his father's house, Pemberton Hall. I googled it. It's way the hell up near York. I take it she's never met the man." "It doesn't sound like it," I say, turning the tap on and squirting a drop of dish soap into the mug Chelani bought me for my last birthday. It's got Van Gogh's likeness with the words, "Go away until I've had my coffee," written on it. "She's dreaming. You'd have a better chance of a yes if you invited the Queen to a sleepover at your flat tonight." "Agreed," I say, letting out a groan. "Why couldn't it have been anyone but him? Maybe someone human with the warmth of an ice cube." "What if you try to seduce him?" she suggests, First of all, ew, no way. Not my type at all, I tell her as my cheeks betray me by heating up. Just
sample complete. Ready to continue?